Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Never Strays Far is brought to you by The Roadbook, the ultimate cycling almanac, and Chapter 3. Enjoy. This, David Miller, is our second attempt to get this podcast done, to get podcasting done, to coin a phrase, and we singularly failed yesterday.
We need a producer and an editor and a director and just technical people, don't we? Because yesterday's was brilliant.
Well, we can say that because no one can prove otherwise now.
It's our greatest ever work.
We're guilty of overreaching somewhat. And I got we did have a chat on the record yesterday, and I took it home and it said a corrupted file, and that was it, game
it's
over.
It's a shame because we even had like a surprise guest on that one as well.
But Alec Briggs, wasn't it?
It was Alec Briggs,
the crit racer and social activist.
He is a social activist.
He's amazing. I was telling my partner about it. I was telling Kath about Alec Briggs and kind of why he's the coolest thing and what, you know. Anyway, that's lost, but all is not lost because you, in your new podcast strand.
In Off Bike, Mikel interviewed Alec. So it is there. Mikel's
so big,
got that.
So that'll be released at some point soon.
Exactly.
In your off-bike strand.
In the other one.
In the other one that just appeared from nowhere, by the way, on the internet.
Yeah.
Right there. So we haven't done one of these for a long time. Loads has happened in the world of cycling, David. I'm sure you've been across every single
detail. Well,
you know
me, Ned. Like glued to cyclingnews.com.
Steve Cummings has retired. You know that because you
listened
to that chat.
Your interview with him. I thought it was very good. And I thought it's they got a lot of time for Steve. And you could see the outpouring as well from the pro peloton towards Steve. And I thought that was such a lovely thing because he is he's almost like the everyman pro cyclist in many ways, isn't he?
Yeah,
I think he was very gracious in that interview he did with you. I thought very humble.
Yeah, I think so, and he was because he messaged me privately after it had been released to say how touched and surprised I think he was because he's one of those guys. He's been so focused, David, on his work, his job, hasn't he, for so long? He's probably not even been, you know, a quarter aware of quite how much his achievements have resonated with the sporting public.
Exactly. He's not the sort of person that would be Googling himself.
No.
And he's probably, you know, and he's not somebody who has ever done it, I don't think, for the stories.
Yeah.
He just did it because he liked bike racing.
Yeah.
And I think that comes across, and I think that came across particularly in that interview. And it also came across in the sense that I loved it in that interview where he said he'd do it till he was like 80 if he could.
Yeah.
And I was like, Jesus,
madness.
But he probably, and I think he meant it as well.
Yeah, and it wouldn't entirely surprise me to see him back on the bike in some sort of guise, you know, in years to come. Well, I don't know what that is. First of all, he's got to get rid of that neck brace. I mean, I had no idea quite how badly he'd been injured at the Tour of Britain, so he's still struggling to get back on the bike. Anyway, it was good of Steve to talk, and I hope you enjoyed that one. A bunch of other stuff. Everyone's on their winter get-togethers with their new teams, aren't they? We touched on this on our aborted podcast yesterday, but everyone's wearing daft kits that don't match on on bikes that don't match your teammates. And
it is like the time of the year. Well, we discussed this yesterday. Whereas November is the reboot time.
Yep.
And the classic professional cycling confusing reboot.
Yeah.
Where we see riders riding for other teams in their old kit.
Yeah.
And you're like, just nothing adds up.
Yeah.
But and it's interesting to see.
Just explain why it is the. I mean, like, I think we both
contracts. It's January the 1st to December 31st.
Your contract always runs from January 1st.
It's a calendar year.
So, but what are you doing working for the opposition in December? Which is essentially what you're doing.
It is, and it's a really weird one because you go there and you're not allowed to wear the new team kit, although you're with the new team. So you'll see, although sometimes a bike you're allowed to ride the new bike.
Yeah,
so it gets even more confusing because you'll have, let's say, Philippe Gilbert. Who's Deceuninck Quickstep, who is now with Lotto on their training camp, and he still has Deceuninck kit, which is brilliant because they're like the two teams that hate each other the most in the world, and they got the biggest Belgian star, and he's with Lotto, and he's in Deceuninck kit.
It's like Manchester United signing a Liverpool star, and he's just got to turn up at the training ground in a Liverpool kit for a month.
It's true when you put it like that. It's just an absolute bonkers. Madness, isn't it?
But I suppose it's just a facet of the fact there are no races. You know, there's no actual conflict of interest.
No, you get the kind of the there's the exhibition races, 6-day races going on. There's other things. The cyclocross season's kicked off pretty strong now, so that's we're deep into that.
Yep.
But apart from that, we've got to wait till January and Tour Down Under, and then what's left of the Middle Eastern races.
Yeah. Can I be slightly contrarian about cyclocross? Because I understand. I mean, we are recording this in the heart of hipster London, right?
Yeah,
we're in a
digital agency.
We're in a digital agency
called Soon in Shoreditch.
In Shoreditch, mate.
In a loft. Studio.
In a loft warehouse conversion.
This literally could not be more
with polished concrete floor.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So simultaneously, we are in the heart of the British cycling public who love cyclocross.
Yeah, we really are, aren't we?
No, because this is the hipster thing. Cyclocross for a number of years now has been the hipster's choice of, you know, like that. I have never been to watch it, although I really think I would quite enjoy the experience of going over and watching one of the big Dutch or Belgian races just to be there. But I have...
I'm surprised by that, Ned.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised by it. By myself. For
I'm
not
surprised
having,
by
I'm
yourself.
I feel I've let myself down a bit.
Yeah, I can picture you there in a barber.
Yeah, one of my assortment of Lewisham Market flat caps.
Yeah, there you go. Quietly standing
Barber
there.
Barber and Wellies, what do you...
Don't know, I just made that up.
Okay, got to go home and think about that now. But I did tune into an internet stream. Our friend and colleague Rob Hatch was commentating on some internet stream, some big race, the one with lots of sand in it. This is how steeped in cyclocross I am. And it was won almost inevitably by Mathieu van der Poel. I think he crashed in the sort of formation lap and then was half an hour off the back and then caught up and then ripped through everyone and then rode off the front. I did not think it was very interesting. I mean, there's a certain shock effect of like, you look at it and you go, blimey, how do they ride through that?
Yeah.
And then they do it again. And you go, blah, how do they ride through that? And then third time around, you go, yeah.
I tell you what, here's a flashback. In the 1980s, when I lived in the UK, I can remember at the weekends on Grandstand, they'd all show cyclocross.
Yeah. They would do. Yeah,
it was huge in the 80s.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, it was on national TV.
Well, World of Sport on ITV used to show double-decker bus racing.
So it's pretty desperate.
It was a different time.
Low budget.
It was a different time.
What are the rights for cyclocross?
Yeah, I mean it is. Listen, I'm being frivolous. It's obviously great. It's got a great culture of its own. You know, in its own right. I just don't.
You've dug the hole, dude.
I worry about it and mountain biking as TV spectacles because they're a little bit. You know, one of the beauties of road racing, the thing that you and I like more than anything else, is because of the way it looks. And because of the fluid dynamics of a big peloton.
And also the multi-layered narratives that exist within it. And it's
cyclocross is about a great deal of technique. I understand that. But ultimately, if you ain't got the power, you're not going to win a race. So it's about putting your foot down and holding your foot down, isn't it? It's weightlifting on a bike.
So that's our review of the cyclocross season complete.
And finally, in my roundup of all the cycling news that's gone on, Steve Cummings is retired. We're not sure about cyclocross. And today, the route for the Vuelta has been announced. Now, you're looking at me with a slight look of panic that I've seen before on your right.
I'm going to open it on my phone.
You haven't seen it yet,
have
you? I've only had a cursory glance. It starts, though, in Utrecht.
Utrecht. That's
where I went to Utrecht a couple of weeks ago.
What were we doing there?
on holiday, interrailing. You know, I've been interrailing twice since I last seen. That's mad. Anyway, I went interrailing and I went to admire. Do you remember the Grand Départ in Utrecht in 2015, David?
Yeah,
you came
that.
And joined
yep.
us. And we, from our hotel to get to the centre of town, we walked through what was essentially a big building site by the railway station.
Mm-hmm.
That's all finished now, and it is Europe's biggest underground bike storage wow. facility. It's like a multi-story car park for bikes. It's just beautiful. It's just immense. It's an amazing facility. But anyway, Utrecht now has become the first city in the Netherlands, or will become, at the Vuelta, to have hosted all three Grand Tours.
Is that, that's
Tour de France in 2015. The Giro went through there the year that Wiggins took pink in Amsterdam.
2010, yeah.
2010. You were there, so you've been, racing.
I was gutted about that.
Were you?
Yeah. Yeah. That was there's a kind of little story behind that, in that I was, against my will, therefore reluctantly, I was sent to do a wind tunnel testing
okay.
in the UK. And this is 2 weeks before the Giro.
Right.
And it was when the Iceland volcano happened.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I was then stuck in the UK for 5 days without my bike, without any of my stuff.
Yep.
And I couldn't train. And so then I turned up to the Giro 2 weeks later, slightly under fitness, and got sixth in the prologue. And so effectively lost the prologue because I'd gone to a wind tunnel.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's not the way it's supposed to happen. You're supposed to go to a wind tunnel in order to win the prologue.
So I was really angry about that.
Detraining. Were you close? Was it sixth, but close?
Like sixth, yeah, close enough.
Close enough to have got you over the line.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the moral of the story is I hate wind tunnels. But Utrecht, so they must love a bicycle in Utrecht.
Well, they certainly do.
Yeah.
They certainly do. And then it spends 3 days. So there's a prologue. Oh, sorry, opening team time trial. Obviously, it's the Vuelta, isn't it? And then two, flattish stages, opportunities. I think overall the verdict is that the Vuelta this year is not as hard. I mean, certainly Matt White has come out and said that it's the, in inverted commas, the easiest Grand Tour I've seen for quite a while. However, there are obviously some significant climbs. I think there's a total of 8 summit finishes, including Angliru, and the Tourmalet finishing on top of the Tourmalet in the Pyrenees. It is not dissimilar, but even more extreme way that the Tour de France is doing next year. It is just ignoring half the country.
Hmm.
So it drops down into, I think we land, the race leaves the Netherlands and goes to the Basque country, and then it just hangs around the Pyrenees and then over to the, right along the northern coast, dipping down inland occasionally, so through Galicia, through Asturias, and then eventually just dipping into Portugal, which is interesting,
interesting,
crossing the border and then heading sort of like in a fairly straight line down towards Madrid with a summit finish again, much like last year on stage 20 before the Madrid ceremonial. One individual time trial of 33 kilometres. Mm. So everybody is moaning about the modern way again. And Inder Ryan has already come out and said, well, that's just modern cycling, isn't it?
Yeah,
so that's precious few, once again, just like the Tour de France, precious few time trial kilometres. And but slightly more moderated, it's not the crazy throw everything at it sort of. So hopefully the wind will, create a race up on that coast that we'd like to see. And hopefully there'll be more of those testing in kind of, neither one thing nor the other kind of stages in difficult terrain, because that might make for a good race.
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, I think the Vuelta is always, it's finding itself now, I think, as a, although it is the younger sibling, I suppose, the Giro and the Tour, regards its status. It's such a great race for the bike races, because it's a gateway. It's a stepping stone to the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia. It's for that reason we often see some of the best racing, because you get all these young guys who are given a chance.
Yeah,
they're cut off the leash, if you like.
Yeah.
And so
Pogacar.
So, exactly.
Oh, that's, that's the other bit of news, Pogacar. David. It's the other bit of news. He's declared himself for the Tour de France this year. But I know. But hilariously, I say this year, next year, hilariously, he has said exactly what he said at the beginning of the Vuelta, which is, I'll be there to support Fabio Aru. How he kept a straight face saying that, I have no idea.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
I mean, have I just got Pogacar. It wrong? Is there a returning champion disguised as Fabio Aru who's going to emerge chrysalis-like into some amazing marauding beast of a racer still? Or is it simply that Pogacar is a better prospect already than Fabio Aru?
I think Pogacar is just a wily little fox, isn't he?
Yep.
He's playing the game. He's Machiavellian.
It's great to have him at the tour, isn't it?
Brilliant. It's going to be awesome.
That's going to be awesome. All right, that's it. That's our entire roundup of race. I can't think of anything else to say. We've done it. We've done racing. We've got racing done. So let's have a bit of music, and then I'm going to ask you about another race. The day was November the something or other. The scene was 2nd of November. The scene was New York.
New York.
David Miller laces his running shoes, puts on his skimpy nylon shorts. I hope you had skimpy athletic nylon shorts.
They were quite fitted, actually.
I'm sure they were.
Yeah.
Chapter 3?
I got chapter 3 written on them.
Good.
Obviously.
Self-branding.
I love the fact that when I launched chapter 3, I was like, I don't want to be a human billboard anymore.
Look and at you, sitting opposite me in a chapter 3 sweatshirt.
I put chapter 3 on everything. I am a human billboard.
You did say that, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I was like, part of the strap lines. Oops. But
And David Miller pins a number onto his back, or his front indeed, on the marathon. And went off to run 26.2 miles of the New York Marathon.
It's a really long way.
It's a really long way.
Yeah. And you've seen, a year and a half ago when we ran together on the first day of the Tour de France, you saw how bad I was at running.
Dropped you, mate. On that lake around the Vendée, that fishing lake.
You totally dropped me and I couldn't walk for 3 days.
But that's not the case now. You have become a bit of a running beast.
Yeah, I'd love it. So it came about because 2018 New York Marathon, I saw on social media, this is where social media can be quite useful and beneficial, one of my friends, a guy called Robbie Ketchell, a picture of him completing the New York Marathon, carrying his baby son across the finish line. Robbie Ketchell had been our sports scientist at Garmin, Slipstream, and we'd worked closely together for years. And he married Mariah Pongras, who was our media liaison. And their baby boy was born in February 2018, with Down syndrome. And so he ran the New York Marathon last year to raise awareness and money for Down syndrome and his son Wyatt. And the goal being to run it in 3 hours, 21 minutes, because Down syndrome is caused by 3 copies of the 21st chromosome. He didn't achieve it in 2018, and that's what the picture was of him crossing the finish line, carrying Wyatt across the line. And he hadn't been able to train, obviously, because it had been a pretty hardcore 6 months with Wyatt. And I just messaged him instantly and said, oh, you know what, I'll do it with you next year. We'll run 3:21 together. And it was a two-stranded thing. I needed a performance objective. I needed to find something that was bigger than myself to do it. I couldn't motivate myself to do anything. So I thought, if I do it for Robbie and Mariah and Wyatt, then I'll definitely do this and I'll follow through. And so I then spent a year training with a goal to do 3 hours, 21 minutes. But then when I got there on the day, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try and go sub 3, because that felt like a properly scary, daunting challenge.
Well, for anyone who doesn't understand marathon times, 3 hours is separates the wheat from the chaff. If you can get under 3 hours, you're a proper athlete. There you go.
Yeah, and I'd never run over 27 kilometers. And so I knew that, and this is what was quite funny, was I got there and I thought it was 42 Ks. And it was 40, I saw it was 42.6 Ks. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. I don't know.
About these last 600
meters. It's like, oh, that's how far I was stretching myself on this one.
And Rob Hales always told me when it was road racing that if he was in some breakaway or some solo attack or something, he would count in Manchester's. And he'd go, internally, he had a Manchester clock, so he'd go, only 10 Manchesters, 10 Manchesters, 10 Manchesters, 9 Manchesters, 9 Manchesters, 9 Manchesters.
That's brilliant.
That would have been 3 extra Manchesters,
exactly.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. So that. It was an amazing experience. I took my training really seriously. I didn't take this lightly. It's not as if I turned up there and just went on talent. I worked really hard for a year to get fit enough and went through gait analysis, 2 or 3 different coaches, and did all cross training and understanding that after our run, the Tour de France, where I was gimped, I realized that I'm going to have to actually learn how to run. Because I took for granted, I thought, I'm a human being, I can run.
Professional cyclists can't stand or walk.
And that was what I realized. You know, you get wind blown up your ass. You're like, you're a great athlete, and you got such class, and you got such form on the bike. And yet, I was like a baby giraffe, injured baby giraffe running.
You were a bit.
And I also then recognised that actually professional cyclists, all we are is an engine. We have no chassis because the bike's a chassis. It's basically we're held up by scaffolding. And so I then had to kind of build a chassis, which took so much work. I got shin splints at the beginning and then had to go back to the drawing board, then had to do the core body and actually turn myself into a bit of a runner. But during that whole process, because I lost quite a bit of time at the beginning because of all the injuries and the shin splints and all these different things. And so by the time a month out, the longest run I'd been able to do was 27 kilometres. And then I'd got sick as well in the 3 weeks before, and it was like, Christ. But the coach I was working with, a wonderful guy called Tom Sturgis, he said, no, you can do this, because I've been doing 5K runs during the Vuelta.
That's right, park runs. Yep.
Park runs. And so I kind of had been benchmarking, and he then figured out, well, you'll be able to do 4:15 pace. And I was like, and I just believed him, and I just totally trusted him. Whereas it seemed kind of unfathomable. And this is what's different between running and cycling. You can hold a much higher intensity for longer. So I could run at 90%, which I couldn't do on a bike. Because at 90% I could probably do for an hour on a bike. Whereas with running, I could hold it for 3 hours,
It's curious, isn't it?
Curious, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is exactly what I did, because I ended up, my average heart rate at the New York Marathon was 162, which is exactly 90%. Of my maximum heart rate.
That's right. You'd have thought that'd be the other way around.
You would have done, wouldn't you? But I think it's because you're using more. I don't understand. To be perfectly frank,
it's a science thing.
Yeah, it's a science. But anyway, and so my sister and I went over. My sister was like my big sponsor. She got all. And actually, we talk about sponsorship. We managed to raise $34,000 for the Down syndrome charity, which was the objective and awareness. And my sister was my kind of personal sponsor. Flew me out there and put me up in the hotel and looked after me to the degree where she was also the CEO of Team Ineos. And 2 days before, or 3 days before when we got there, she said, well, so what's your fueling strategy? And I was like, oh, I think I got it pretty nailed for the day. I got all my gels. I got a kind of schedule built in and everything. And she's like, no, but I mean from now till the race. And I was like, well, just eat pasta, right? And this is a really amazing wake-up call. You suddenly realize the detail that she and they work in.
Yeah.
And so she hit up their nutritionist, and this is where it's quite lovely. She's my young, obviously we're so close, but she said it's weird now. I kind of forget that if I ask somebody to do something, they just do it. So I'm the CEO. So I just thought before, but could you do this? And now, so she asked the nutritionist, and he came back a few hours later with this like 3-page, heavily detailed fueling plan for the 3 days before, taking into account every single meal. My body weight, my estimated effort, etc., and what I needed to eat every meal, and the absolute volume, etc., and what to eat. And so I was like, Christ, this is amazing. And so I got into that, and I started to then slip into my old habits, which I hadn't expected to happen. And the race on the Sunday, and because I was so scared of the fact that I was going to have to do this race, I didn't think I was going to be able to run at 4:15. I was going on a wing and a prayer. I knew I had to do everything right. And I woke up on a Saturday morning, and it was like I'd gone to bed 5 years ago and woken up, in the sense that I woke up as old athlete me, the time trialist. And it was such a lovely place. That Saturday was just such a peaceful place where I didn't have to do anything. I just thought about the race, and I thought about my fueling, and I thought about just how I was going to do it. And just just removed all the noise from my life. And then the next morning when I got to the race, it was as if I was the younger version of me, going to start Tour de France prologue. And I felt exactly like that. And it gave me such a sense of purpose again. You know, and it was really weird.
I just remembered the last marathon I ran.
Go on, tell
me. My fueling strategy. For the first time, I had a slight ear infection going in. And I'd never taken to that point in my life, I'd never had antibiotics before in my life.
What?
I know, mad, isn't it? But I went to a doctor, got some antibiotics. I didn't realise one of the side effects of antibiotics is terrible diarrhea.
It's true.
So I turned up the Amsterdam Marathon, suffering greatly. But on my way to Amsterdam, at the little branch of Boots, I picked up, again, for the first time in my life, a packet of Imodium Extra.
Brilliant.
So I was on the start line, like simultaneously pressing the accelerator and the brake on my body. Yeah, I had no idea what to do. Yeah, I also popped some codeine halfway round.
Legend.
had some like taped
just prepping.
Gaffer taped to my elbow, and I went, I might need that later
on.
An
old school pro cyclist.
Oh, completely. Pop belge and the lot. Anyway, sorry, I interrupt you. You're there.
Yeah, and so then it starts, and it's huge. You know, it's the biggest marathon in the world. It's 50,000 people start, so you're put off in waves. And I'd put, when I'd put my entry in, I'd put down, my estimated finish time was going to be 3 hours 21 minutes, because that was the goal. And so I was starting in that wave, which then meant, because it starts sort of Staten Island and you're straight up a bridge. And I was immediately off pace because I was surrounded by people who were running at a much slower pace. And so I ended up in this panic, dodging, trying to get through people for the first 5Ks and going too hard, basically. And but then I got into it, found the people that were on my pace. And then I fell into this lovely kind of sort of, I knew that it was going to get really, really hard. Kind of, it's that old saying, you don't chase it, it will come. Kind of when you're in one of those efforts, you just have to kind of stay calm. And I knew it was coming. And sure enough, at 30Ks, 32Ks, it came.
Classic.
Oh, yeah. And I knew that because it's obviously, it's not just the fact that everybody knows you hit the wall at 30Ks. It's also, that's 2 hours of effort. So after 2 hours, you've exhausted all your glycogen. And also the fact that I hadn't been able to drink properly because I hadn't, that was one thing I hadn't thought about was I'd never tried to drink from a cup while running.
So you just threw water all over your face?
Like, yeah, just like literally just splashing my tongue. And it was so dehydrating as well. It was a beautiful day. But then I went into the last hour and everything started to fall apart and really badly. I was using earphones, which from hardcore runners would be disgusted at, but I kind of was just on a performance advantage. So I had my old Trigger music on Underworld just on repeat. And so I just kept heading back to the song Jumbo, just keep me calm. And I started to think about, okay, I can do this. I was doing all the mental arithmetic, so my pace was slowing down and I could still scrape it in. And then I started to think about why I was doing it. Why am I doing this? And then I was thinking about Wyatt, and I was thinking about Mariah and Robbie. And then I thought, actually, I remember Steve Peters telling me once that if you really want to go really deep, think about a family member, a blood family member.
Yeah.
Because for some reason, we can find more strength for blood family.
Yeah.
The test is that they put your hand in ice cold water and ask you to think about somebody, different people, and you can always hold it in longer when it's a blood relative, even if you don't like them.
Yeah.
It's a really weird thing. So I started thinking about Nicole and the kids, but I started thinking about my sister at the finish line. I think she'd be so proud of me if I'm going to sub 3. And so I was just by the other, and then the last 5 kilometers, it was just, I was literally kind of speed walking.
Yomping. Performance yomping.
Just trying to get my foot off the ground.
Yeah.
And this was what was really weird. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed again, kind of like the day before, I enjoyed the fact that that was the only thing in the world I had to think about. And there was a peace to it.
And your time?
2 hours, 58 minutes and 57 seconds.
Chapeau, David.
Thank you.
That's Ned. Very, very far. I understand New York is one of the toughest because of all the bridges and the Central Park.
It was an amazing experience.
But no, that's immense.
I recommend it. Well, not really. Not really.
Crazy sport. Oh. All right. That was amazing for anyone. I'm sure there's many people listening who've a lot of, that'll ring a lot of bells with people, I think.
Yeah.
Because the strange thing is, it's not just a muscular thing or a mental thing, is it? But I think it affects bits of your body that you don't normally anticipate being affected. Like you talk about, you know, you couldn't get your leg over the curb.
Yeah.
I think it affects the neural pathways, you know, and your legs actually stop doing what you're asking them to do. You know? It's just bizarre.
It took me a month to recover, which was, I didn't expect either.
It's a pretty bruising thing. Yeah. All right, let's pause there. And I've got a special treat. We'll have a little bit of music. And I caught up with our mate in our South American correspondent.
Yeah.
You know who. He's coming up after this. Rendell. Matt Rendell.
Yes, that's me, I think. That's me. Is that me?
What is your marathon, your personal best? I know you've run multiple marathons. What is your best time ever recorded, Matt Rendell?
The best time I've ever recorded is 3 hours and 19 seconds. It's not very good. But I've been very close to... I was on schedule for 3 hours once in Drenthe in Holland. And then... And it was it was one of those marathons with a get-out clause, which is a really bad idea, where you do a series of loops. So you go past a place where you can stop. And I started getting this grinding in my right hip. And I thought, no, this ain't right. This ain't right. So I stopped, and I was going really well. I mean, this is 10 years ago, and I since then, I have nurtured the entirely unrealistic and probably stupid ambition of running not a 2-hour marathon but a 3-hour marathon. And funnily enough, watching Eliud Kipchoge some weeks ago, my ambition was reignited, because I did think that his 2-hour marathon was extraordinary and inspiring. So it may lead me to kill myself of a massive heart attack as I attempt to run a 3-hour marathon, in which case, Messrs. Ineos, my blood will be on your hands.
Absolutely. I think you misspoke earlier. I think you said that your personal best was 3 hours 19 seconds. That's what you said. I think you meant 3 hours 19 minutes, didn't you?
I might have done.
Yeah. So if I say to you that David Miller has just done the New York Marathon in 2:58 something or other, how irritating is that?
That's enormously irritating. Yeah.
But you've correctly identified the methodology that you need to adopt, because he completely Ineos'd himself. He has a family connection with Ineos.
He does.
And he basically got all the help. I mean, it was almost as if he was running the New York Marathon with a green laser in front of him and lots of outrunners. But anyway, we digress.
Matt, to reach. Yeah. Go on.
Yeah. This podcast, we've barely spoken about cycling so far. So let's talk about cycling, and let's talk about you and South America for a change. You've been back about a week or so. What did you get up to in this last trip?
Gaw, I had an extraordinary time, a wonderful time. I went to Barranquilla on the Caribbean coast, which is very, very hot. And I watched Peter Sagan get very, very hot, actually in quite close proximity, because Peter Sagan has a Sagan Fondo, or a leg of his series of Grand Fondos, in Colombia. And so I went and did it and wrote about it. And it was very hot and breathless, and we went up and down a closed motorway. And that didn't make much difference for most people, because they were pretty thrilled to be in close proximity to Peter Sagan and to Fernando Gaviria, who was there as well. But he only did 100 kilometres, which was about 3 or 4 kilometres more than I did. And then Peter Sagan did 160 with everyone else, was not enormously smiley. And I put that down to him having... at the time of year when most people are resting, made a visit to the specialised wind tunnel in San Diego, and then he's got a Gran Fondo there, and then he's got all sorts of duties for photography and endorsements and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, he's been traipsing around the world doing long-haul flights. When he could have been resting up, and but that said, he is a enormous money making machine, and that imposes responsibilities and temptations, and so that was very interesting.
So I guess Matt, even Peter Sagan sometimes tires of being Peter Sagan. That's the conclusion that you draw.
That's very much my conclusion. Yes, he is. Yeah. Actually, funnily enough, I was talking to the boss of 100%, which is that brand of, you know, sort of ski goggles, or I think they're
motocross goggles. The silly things he always wears. Speaking. He wears them on the podium, doesn't he? Or on the podium, dangling around his neck. sort of thing, yeah, yeah.
And he was going, oh, you know, he's a really interesting guy. He's got a really interesting portfolio of endorsements. And I said, oh, yeah. Is that Peter, though, or is that, you know, Lombardi and Gabriele Ubaldi, his sort of handlers and advisors and management team? And he said, oh, well, same thing, really, isn't it? And I thought, oh, is it? maybe it is if you're, yeah, maybe it is if you're a sponsor. Maybe it is just the same thing. I'm not sure it is for Pete himself. But anyway, I mean, they do their job, don't they? So that was very good. Yeah. So that was enormously hot. And then from there, I flew to Bogota, and then the following morning, very early, to Ipiales on the Ecuadorian border, crossed the border, and met Richard Carapaz and spent 4 days with Richard Carapaz, which were four of the most illuminating, fulfilling, exciting, fun days I've ever spent as a journalist. And as you know, I have lots of fulfilling and fun days. So it was exceptionally good. And he's an exceptional man. And it was very
and you
cold.
Also think sorry Matt, you also think that his victory has got a bit lost in the narrative of, I suppose, the Giro got blown away by the Tour de France this year, didn't it, just in terms of, you know, the stories. But you were suggesting to me in a conversation earlier that you think Carapaz is not only the real deal, but he is right up there in the top echelon of GC Grand Tour contenders for 2019.
Absolutely.
Sorry, 2020.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. And I mean, I interpreted such as needed interpreting at the movie star press conference before the Giro, and I was flabbergasted. And you know that I'm sort of geographically skewed that I am accused of being geographically skewed, and especially interested in Latin American riders and cycling.
That's fair enough.
Carapaz, having finished fourth the previous year in the Giro, and with a stage win, and without his team behind him, he was, and having also heard that, you know, lab tests suggest that he is seriously gifted. He was very, very much among my favourites to win the Giro this year. And I was amazed not only that he wasn't among other people's favourites to win the Giro, but also that there were no questions for him at the pre-Giro press conference, or rather there was sort of question for Richard, do you think you can do all right in this Giro? There was one of those.
Isn't it funny? It's really it is very strange, the Carapaz effect, you know.
And I do think that, I mean, and I remember on the second rest day, you know, there were lots of comments from, there were comments from Vincenzo Nibali and Primoz Roglic, both of whom I admire greatly as the way they comport themselves as athletes. And they both sort of said, yeah, we might have made a mistake by letting him get up the road so far. Well, except that certainly wasn't what I saw. And I know that, you know, afterwards that there's a way in which some varieties of journalism work, especially when the journalists are concentrated together in a press tent, where there comes to be a consensus of what happened. And that consensus quite often doesn't look at all like what happened. And what happened, according to the consensus, was that Nibali and Roglic let Carapaz get up the road. But I was there and watching the race, and that isn't what happened. He rode away from him, and they could do nothing about it. They did not have the strength to go after him, and God knows they tried. I think he's the real deal. I think it took him a long time to get to Europe because he's Ecuadorian, and he had to first establish himself in Ecuador, then establish himself in in Colombia, and then when he finally got to in 2016, he did 2 months with the strongman team in Colombia, then went to Lizarte, which is the kind of nursery team that feeds Movistar. And when Lizarte kind of saw what they got, wow, he went straight to Movistar and, you know, obviously became the first Ecuadorian ever to ride in the World Tour. But, you know, there was, as soon as people, at every stage in his career, when people have said, you know, when people have realised, wow, look at this guy, he's immediately made that step. And it's taken him a little bit longer. But yeah, I think he's absolutely the real deal. Absolutely. And an amazing, super fascinating guy. Mm.
Yeah, I was going to say, what I don't want to do is allow you to spike the article that you're going to be writing about. I mean, don't do that, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
But, just in very brief terms, amazing, lovely, open, human with a wonderful backstory, right? Again.
Yeah, absolutely. And also a rare thing for a journalist to experience, a writer to experience, where you go and meet someone and he had sort of, he came up with an itinerary and each day he took us to go and do things and see places associated with his life. And once we got there and had a mooch around and had a look, he sort of said, right, now the reason we're here is this. And he revealed a facet of his existence that on each day had me going, wow, that's, I did not guess this. And it was pretty, it was special. It was very special. So in a sense, I sort of didn't have to, I didn't really have to write very, I mean, you know, he wrote the piece himself, really. Or he structured the piece itself and just left me to sort of write down the words. And I have a sentence for you, which kind of derives from that experience, which is this. As Nibali and Roglic found during the 2019 Giro, each time you think you've captured Richard Carapaz, he escapes you. And that's pretty much what happened. And he's a fabulous and engaging guy and just taking his very, very first steps in English as well. So I'd be interested to see how far he gets with that.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how unique an experience that is that you've just had with Richard Carapaz, Matt Rendell, because I can tell you that I have been taken for a cup of coffee by Andy Tennant to meet his parents once.
So there you go. Well, there we
are. I don't want to boast,
we all like to think we're special, but you've spiked me, haven't you?
Yeah. And then back to Colombia for you? Was it back to Colombia after a few days hanging out with Richard?
Then I went back to Colombia and led a little group of international cycling commentators on the back of a little tester scheme, road tested by your good self a year ago when we went to see Ivan Sosa and various other people. And an enjoyable time was had by all. I accompanied a little group of cycling commentators from various countries, friends from around the place, and we wandered around Colombia for 6 days and went to Narrow-Quintana's Gran Fondo, and that was pretty amazing. And I was hoping, and the idea was that they would get a first experience of Colombia and enjoy it. And in their own good time, if they see fit to do so, talk about it or write about it tell people that, you know, it was fun and a pretty good place to go. And so we went to Nairo's Gran Fondo and it was pretty amazing because we went to reception, and at the reception I was hoping that my friends would get the chance to spend, you know, a couple of minutes in Nairo's company at least. And we went to this reception a couple of nights before the Gran Fondo, and there was Nairo together with Egan and Sergio Andres Higuita. And
Winner Anacona was winner there?
A winner was there, absolutely, and Dyer.
Yep.
And there was also Hernando Borges, who rides for Astana. who had a, I didn't know this, who had a fractured pelvis this season, which is why we didn't see much of him this season. Superman Lopez couldn't be there, but he was there at the Gran Fondo and sort of was, you know, the life and soul. And there was just this great array. There was Sebastian Milano and his brother, and this great array of World Tour cyclists, about 12 or 14 of them. And that was pretty fantastic. And when I'd done that, I went to a very poor area of Bogota, and my friend sort of said, "Are you sure you want to go there?" And I went and did some interviews and some research on the re-Indianization or re-ethnicization of Muisca Indian communities who were there when the Spanish arrived 450 years ago. But the city expanded to sort of take them over and effectively conspired to dispossess them of their lands and their identities and their language and their distinctive customs and so on and so forth. And they are trying to reconstitute themselves as an indigenous group. So having become the urban poor, they're trying to rediscover their indigenous identity, which is interesting. And it's something I have an interest in because Nari Quintana also is of Muisca heritage, so that ties into cycling as well. So that was very interesting. And then in the end, I spent a couple of days with Pablo Masuera, who was Egan Bernal's first sponsor and worked with Egan for 5 years. His project continues, so I went to sort of see him working with his current generation of riders in order to understand how it was that he must have worked with Egan, and to talk to him about that, and to talk about, you know, not just where did Egan come from, but where will the next Egan come from. So that was very, very interesting and great fun. And he's Pablo Masuera is a very charismatic and interesting man, and has a fabulous group of young athletes coming through. And I'm sure, I mean, Pablo brought through Egan and Brandon Smith Rivera, who is now, as you know, riding for Ineos as well. One of Egan's oldest and closest friends. So he's got a pretty good hit list. He said in the past 9 years, he's worked with about 18 athletes. And I don't know how many of them are professional, but I would say quite a lot of them. I'd say a good proportion of them, probably 50% of them. And two of them are with the world's top cycling teams. That's a pretty damn good average.
It is indeed. Mm. And Matt, but just very briefly, where the fruits of your labours, where are these words going to be printed in the coming weeks and months?
There's going to be some stuff in pro cycling, some stuff in Ruler.
Yeah.
And then... Yeah.
You don't care, really. Whoever's going to pay you, whoever pays, that's where you go. You have no loyalty. You never have had. Yeah.
Well, I wish I had a bit more loyalty to cold, hard cash. Bit here, bit there.
Right.
And what I'm planning to do really is to find five or six loyal publications, more loyal to me than I am to them, who will commission me to sort of do, you know, two or three big pieces on Colombia in the course of a year. And that would give me 10 to 15 pieces over the course of the year. And that would be enough to go out and spend a year, a couple of years doing what I used to do a long time ago, which is, you know, spend much more of my life in South America, which in Colombia, because it really is becoming much, you know, when I was going there in the 2000s, there were probably only three or four professional cyclists, and it wasn't at all about success. It was about cycling as a sort of, you know, anthropological curiosity. But now, of course, there's masses of success and masses of stars. And what I was doing, you know, 10, 15 years ago, should in theory become much more doable, much more feasible. So that's the plan. That's the plan.
Sounds an excellent plan, Matt. I'll wish you a happy Christmas, and I will see you in the following decade. Does the decade change at the end? Yeah, I suppose it does. Yeah. So we'll spend let's hopefully spend another decade together, because we've had a few.
I like it. Virtually. Virtually, yes.
Yeah, virtually. Never face to face. I'd rather keep it virtual.
I'll see you over Christmas, mate. I'll see you over Christmas. All right. Got to record my audio book, haven't I? So,
yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You're coming to stay. I forgot. You're coming to stay at my house in a few weeks.
I'll see you then. All right. That is to say, in 2 weeks' time, yeah. I'll be on your floor. All right, mate.
I totally forgot. See you, mate.
Bye. See you, mate.
So, Rendell, with his typical enthusiasm, David, for Richard Carapaz and Ecuador and Nairo and all that, and Egan, and, you know, and that's Rendell, isn't it?
That's Rendell. Should we get a random guess quickly? Alex, who's a... Let's just get Alex?
Yep. I didn't know. I thought we had this whole Shoreditch place to ourselves.
He's on earphones. I'm going to get Alex quickly because he's a great chat.
Okay, I'll just hold the fort here while you go and do that. Or maybe I'll edit this bit out.
Hello.
Hi, Alex.
Hello there.
We've not met. Tell me something amazing that will that will interest our podcast listeners. I'm sure you're capable of doing that.
Actually, we do. It's one of our longest lasting websites, actually.
So the microphone didn't quite pick that up. You do the Ineos?
Yeah, so we've worked with originally Team Sky and now Team Ineos.
Right.
Now they've changed from light blue to burgundy. It's good, yeah. They've been one of our best clients over the years. It's been great
very
fun.
Very good. So do you get to meet the riders and stuff in the part of that?
On occasion.
Yeah.
Most of the time it's Fran, which is, I got to say, I like. She's amazing.
Yeah. I'm amazed you know her first name. I thought she was just referred to as the CEO.
The boss. Is what she's referred to, on a general basis.
Yeah. So has the new kit been launched?
The new kit,
or is it the new kit? Is the old kit? Is that right, or something?
It was a strange year because
it happened just before the Tour de Yorkshire last year, didn't it? So yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So they had to use one of the emergency kit change moments to get everything switched over super quickly because it all happened very fast.
By which you mean in the UCI regulations, you can change your kit once.
That's it.
That's right. And they played that shot. So, but that doesn't stop them relaunching a new kit for 2020, does it?
No.
So has it you
I don't think that is not out yet, no.
Embargoed.
It's embargoed.
Come on, what can you tell us?
I can't say anything.
Yeah, come on. So total colour
look,
change.
I'm gonna
read your body language to see if you're lying or not.
I'm a mushroom, I'm kept in the dark and made to
I
eat.
Don't believe you, Alex. Okay, all right. Well, on a scale, is it a radical departure in any way?
Can't say anything.
That's so disappointing.
I'm sorry.
If I was sat here opposite the designer of Wanty Group Gobert, he would have told me everything.
Of course he would.
Everything about the kit.
I know, but I'm English and I can't break profile, break habit.
Yeah, very good. Very good. And are you a cycling... does it suck you in, draw you in the sport?
I'm a regular cyclist. No,
Alex
is now
tapping his girth, which is entirely moderate, in my
Thank
opinion.
Thank you,
but,
I appreciate that. Yeah, I love it. I mean... Yeah. It's strange, but then I get to listen to you guys commentating every year, which is super
nice. Or sitting in the corner of your office doing a podcast when you're trying to do some work.
Very much so, but it's not. I mean, it's I probably watch the Tour de France every year because you know you got to do that. But I like to ride. I've actually got the
You work in Shoreditch, so clearly you rode a fixie to work, right?
Well, it's coming up for the 10th anniversary of when I did John O'Groats Land's End.
Oh, really?
We did Land's End.
Puts David's 26.2 miles in New York.
We did John O'Groats Land's End, and this time on the 10th anniversary, we're going to go the other way.
What?
So we did Joggle, and now we're going to do La Jog.
You're doing it the right way around.
Yeah, we're doing
time.
It the right way around. So this you're, time.
So you're only the second person I've ever met in my life
really?
Who's done it the wrong way around. The first friend of mine, Gavin, did it the wrong way around, but because of complete ignorance. He did no research whatsoever and just set off from John O'Groats and was passed over the course of the first morning by about four different groups of people going the other way. And only then did he realise, it's headwind all the way, isn't it?
Oops.
Basically a headwind all the way.
Well, I didn't believe it. And
you never get a northeasterly wind.
My parents live in Devon, so I was like, look, let's go down there because we're going to be in Cornwall when we finish up.
Yeah.
So it's an easy ride back. But then we realised pretty quickly that if you're riding unsupported, you've got massive panniers on. You basically just got sail on the bike. So we definitely felt it.
Yeah.
going the other way. So having exhaustively tested the incorrect way to do it, now 10 years older, we're going to do it. It's all downhill, you see.
It's all downhill.
That's the my friend
Tim Moore, who wrote a brilliant book called, what's it called? The Cyclist Who Came In From the Cold, that's what it's called.
Oh, nice.
He rode an East German shopping bike the length of the Iron Curtain a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And it took him months and months. It's a long way, 10,000 kilometers or something, and on his East German shopping bike. And
amazing.
He was told, start in the warmer climates in May, and by the time you get up to northern Finland, it'll be like, it'll have warmed up
balmy.
A bit. He went, yeah, that's logical, but it's going up the map, isn't it? I can't do it. It would just feel uphill the whole way.
It's not an even slope as you ride up the planet.
Anyway, when are you doing this Lejog thing? When are you
So it'll be next... No, 21 is all when right. We're going to do it. So we got, because I've got kids, I have to put the bid in significantly early.
Yeah,
as it's going to take me
and
really quite a long
time. The kit you're riding,
is
that going to be embargoed, or can you tell me what?
No, I'm allowed to. What on the bicycle?
Yes,
Condor Fratello.
Right.
It's still going. I love that bike.
Of course, Condor.
I didn't want to do it on a full touring bike.
No,
I'm just going to kill myself.
Yeah,
42. Yeah. Too old for this.
Get over yourself. right, brilliant. Nice to meet
Marvellous.
You,
Alex. Nice to meet you, too.
David, you're off to do something, aren't you? And whatever. And I wish you all a happy Christmas. And to all our podcast listeners as well, happy Christmas. Merry New Year. See you in 2020.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com